Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode number 40 for Monday, April 5th, 2010. Life, language, and science. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Welcome, everybody, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford. That's me. And as usual, this is 1 hour, one topic with one expert. So we're going to get down and dirty. And today we're getting down and dirty in the Amazon jungle. We're talking with Daniel Everett, who has spent several years, a majority of his life, studying the languages of an Amazonian tribe, and has written a book called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, about his experiences in the Amazon jungle and the work that he's done in linguistics and how he is contributing to our understanding of human language abilities. Have you ever wondered what the world would be like without language? How would you communicate, identify objects, or even think? Would we even have culture? Language scientists or linguists have been asking these questions for years and years and years. Noam Chomsky is probably the first name that comes to mind for most people among the famous linguists and cognitive scientists who have had a huge impact on our understanding of language. One of his most significant ideas is that language would not be possible without a concept called recursion, in which statements can be embedded within other similar statements ad infinitum. You can think of sentences and other parts of statements like Russian nesting dolls fitting discreetly inside one another, one inside the next. According to Chomsky, it's this recursive language ability that defines the human mind and separates us from animals that have communicative abilities, but not necessarily language. However, there is a small tribe of Indians in the Amazonian jungle whose language may just prove that we don't need recursion to be human after all, and that, in fact, culture may be a more defining aspect of language development than previously thought. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Daniel Everett. Thank you. You're from Illinois State University. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me.
You're welcome. So tell me a little bit about what initially got you to the point that you needed to go to the Amazon to study language and people.
Well, I got interested in the Amazon originally because in high school in California back in the 60s, I met a family of missionaries who were just back from the Amazon, and I became a Christian and got interested in being a missionary myself. So I initially went to the Amazon in 1977 as a missionary to translate the New Testament for a tribe of Amazonian Indians. And the mission had asked us to work with this group that no one else had been able to really figure out their language, the Pitahã.
Pitahã. That's how you say the name?
That's right.
Now, I've been reading your book, and forgot to bring it into the studio with me today, but I've been reading your book. We've been reading it as part of the This Week in Science book club this last month. It was our book of the month. And the thing I find really interesting is the way that you spell the words versus the way that the sounds actually are made. There's a glottal stop sound that has an X. They use an X to represent it. And
right.
Did you come up with all of these standards for the way that the words are written?
Well, actually, all of the symbols that we use to write Pitahã are based on the International Phonetic Alphabet, except for the X, which is a sort of strange choice to represent a glottal stop, which we find that English doesn't use glottal stop as a distinctive sound, but we have it in a few words like so it's the break between those two. So in Pinaha, the word for macaw is ka'ai, and the word for alligator is ka'ai, with the glottal stop separating the different vowels. We chose an X to represent that just because the glottal symbol back in those days wasn't available on a typewriter. There weren't computers. Nobody had laptops or personal computers when I started working with the Pinaha. So, I had to. Missionaries before me had done a lot of work on the analysis of the sound system to come up with the writing system of Pinaha, but it fell to me to complete the work and really figure out what sounds the Pinaha perceive as distinctive. And so the way it's written now is based on that analysis.
And so back in 1977, you got started. I mean, you took your family to the jungle, which I find that amazing that, you'd take your whole family. I think many researchers and many, maybe was it a missionary thing to go with your entire family? Because I know lots of people who would leave their kids at home.
Was back in those days. I mean, if I were going back today the way that I am now and as young as I was then, just to do linguistics research, I doubt if I would have taken my family. But we were going there to live there,
right?
You know, and become not necessarily part of the people because we thought in those terms, becoming part of the Pinaha, becoming part of the daily life there, and our children were important to that. So they were homeschooled. We're the only school around, and they played with the Pinaha children, and my daughters would take off early in the morning with Pinaha girls in a canoe, and I wouldn't see him again until the evening. And my son, when he was just a year old. By the time he was 3 years old, he was running around with the Pinaha boys shooting bows and arrows.
Do you think your kids were really influenced in their lives by a Pinaha way, the way of life of living in the jungle? Were they there long enough to actually have, the way they look at the world influenced?
They probably spent 3 to 4 months a year for a period of 10 years going into the jungle. There were times we spent longer. In 1980, we spent the entire year in the village. I guess the best way to see how it affected them is what they're doing today. Mm. So my oldest daughter, Shannon, is a missionary in Brazil, living very near the Pinaha. Mm. My son, Caleb, is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Miami, and his specialty is Amazonian cultures, of all things. And my middle daughter, Chris, is a doctor of nursing practice in Charlotte, North Carolina, and she spends a good deal of her summers giving free medical help to indigenous peoples and poor people of Brazil.
Wow. So I think I'd say that they are definitely influenced by their formative years down there. Do you think, they've all seemed to have gone into like a medical and a scientific side of things. Did you get them involved in your scientific research? Did you get them listening to the words? Are they, and helping you with what you were doing there at all?
Well, we talked about everything as a family. I mean, we were an entire society, the five of us. We were the only speakers of English that my children knew for most of each year in the early years. And so we talked about everything. I remember Shannon, when she was about 6 years old, coming in talking to me about what a specific word meant, because you could use it here and you could use it there and you could use it there. So it must mean this, right, Dad? Mm-hmm. And so they all got to be very interested in language and figuring things out. And they would sometimes correct me and point out things that the Pinaha wouldn't actually say it that way. So we worked together on it.
Yeah. Can you tell me what, the book that you've written is just such a fascinating story on so many levels, your personal story and additionally the scientific story that you tell. Can you give a little summary of the book to our listeners?
Yeah, the book has three parts. The first part is just called Life. And it's what it was like to live in the Amazon and to try to understand the Pinaha as a human being trying to understand fellow human beings. And so it talks about taking my family in there, and our first trip, my wife and daughter almost dying of malaria, and me not knowing how to get out of there because we had been flown in, and now we had to go out by boat. And we talk. And so I talk about that trip. I talk about a time when I inadvertently offended all the Pitahā and woke up during the night to hear them talking about killing me and my family.
Oh my,
and I had to disarm them and talk them out of that. And it was a good thing that I had been working on the language, or I wouldn't have been able to talk them out of anything. I talk about learning about the Pitahā's own concepts of life and death, and the growing awareness that I had that they based their culture and understanding of life on immediacy, what goes on today. They weren't worried about the distant past or the distant future. They were focused on today and how this affected me. And then I talk about lessons I learned from Brazilians who live along the rivers on the way to the tribe, and the experience of being a family in a foreign country. The second part of the book is called Language, and I try to talk reasonably non-technical terms about the importance of the language for our theorizing about the nature of human language. What is it about this particular language? And I don't make the case that a lot of people seem to have thought that I make, that the Pitahā are you alone in this. I'm sure there are other languages around the world, when we look at them more carefully, that will have similar lessons that will support the lessons of the Pitahā for us. But this was my experience. So I talk about the lessons I learned about the language, and we could talk more about recursion if you want to, and why I don't think it has recursion, and just the different aspects of the language that don't just make Pitahā unusual, but the lessons that Pitahā has for the nature of the human mind and the nature of human beings and our language. And then the third part of the book, I talk about my loss of faith and why my respect for the Pitahā and their demands of evidence for my claims about God led me to question those very claims and become what I am today, which is a non-believer.
Which I think is probably one of the more interesting aspects to the story. I mean, it is tied in very tightly to all of the scientific study, the cultural study, the language study. You know, so if we start there, I mean, it follows the progression of what you were learning from these people. Do you think did you just learn so much, get yourself so engrossed in their culture that's where it all, the change in your belief, your religious beliefs came from?
I wouldn't say that some people have tried to say that I went native as an expression. I mean, recently the book came out in German, and I've been getting messages from German Christians telling me that it's too bad that I never saw Jesus face to face, because they certainly have. I respected the Pitahā's worldview as I learned to speak their language. They're a beautiful people. They're a sweet people. They're self-sufficient people. And they were my teachers. I went there to be their teacher, but it turned out that I didn't know much when I compared my knowledge to theirs. And they were teaching me a lot. So I did not go native. I speak the language well, but I'm still who I am. And I'd rather stay in a 5-star hotel in Paris than a little hut on the banks of the jungle river sometimes, not always,
even though you've spent over 7 years of your life on the banks of a jungle river.
Yeah, that's right. I spent almost 8 full years of my life on the banks of a jungle river. My friends who visited me there say that they never see me more relaxed and more peaceful than when I'm down there. So obviously it seems to have a good effect on me. But talking to the Pitahā, I mean, one day they came in and they said, "Hey, Dan, you know, you're trying to tell us about Jesus, and before you there was another missionary that tried to tell us about Jesus, and we just want to tell you, we don't want to hear about Jesus. That's okay for Americans, but we're Pitahā, and Pitahā, we like to drink, and we like to have a good time, and we don't believe in Jesus. We've never seen him." So they said, but anyway, what does he look like? And is he brown like us, or is he white like you? Is he tall? Is he short? What does Jesus look like? And I had to tell them that I didn't know. And they said, well, what did your father say he looked like? And I said, well, my father didn't see him either. My father didn't believe in him either. And then they looked puzzled, and they asked me with genuine interest, why are you telling us about him if you have never seen him? And, you know, people have different responses to things that happen in their life. I'm sure that there are many Christians that would not have affected. It would have just made their faith all the stronger. But for me, it made me question what I was doing. You know, these people were being genuinely interested in what they would never tell me stories about things they hadn't seen. Why right. was I telling them stories about things I hadn't seen?
Right. And that gets at something that's very central to those people, is that what you call the immediacy of experience, or the they only talk about things that they have seen. They have to have experienced something, and they believe if it's a dream that it's a different, they've still seen it. And so
That's
they can
right.
tell you about it. Or also some stories that you put forward in the book where various individuals would act out the parts of being a spirit or something.
Right.
And it's almost like play acting. But did they ever ask you if Jesus was like a ghost or a spirit to you, the same way that they saw spirits?
Well, they haven't asked me that, but there's a part in the book where I talk about them claiming to have seen Jesus come down as one of these other kinds of entities. I translate that as spirit in the book, but it gives a false impression. I mean, it's not really a spirit. It's another kind of living thing that is a real living thing, but it's not like us. So so they think they saw Jesus, and he was a fairly nasty guy wanting to rape all the girls in the village. And so they said, we don't really want this guy around anymore. I have no explanation for what they saw or how they came up with that conclusion, but
yeah.
they were pretty scared about him.
Wow. So they themselves say they saw him and they didn't like him. They didn't, and that's it. End of story. Don't talk to us about him anymore.
That's right. That particular village said that. And I have many times seen these jungle entities with them. There have been times, one that I talk about at the very beginning of the book, where they see a jungle entity and I see nothing. And that really puzzled me.
Right.
But there have been other times when it is like play acting and the people come down. But it would be simplifying, I think, to call it play acting, because the person, you know, like I have on film right now for this documentary that's being made about the Pitahā.
Yeah, which
A spirit talking to me, and he says, oh, I look like this one Pitahā, but I'm not him. He's gone. And so the next day you talk to this Pitahā that was clearly the spirit, and he says, oh, was there a spirit here last night? I don't know. I wasn't here. So it really means something to them, this other kind of entity.
Yeah.
And it is somewhat like fiction to them, but it's not quite the same because they believe in it. There are just overlapping categories that we can't really. It would be very easy to say this is their form of drama. This is this is fiction, but it's not quite that. But yet at the same time, it's not religion, and it's not belief in an entity that you can't touch.
Yeah, and there's something that you've alluded to in as well as the way that their language works, their lack of concepts for the past or
right.
the future. They live in the present. They experience everything in the present. They don't have numbers. They don't count
right.
things. How do you think this all ties into the way that they use language, the way that they develop as culture? How do you think that all ties in?
Well, it ties in two ways. First, the immediacy of experience that I talk mm-hmm. about, and I'll talk about it a bit more. And also the fact that they're a society, what some anthropologists and linguists would call a society of intimates. Everybody knows mm-hmm. everybody in this society. Imagine that if you walked out of your house, you never saw anyone you hadn't seen before, that you knew every single person that you ever saw. You knew about their history, about their background, what they did. There was no specialization in the society, so there were no doctors and lawyers, and there were always, we all did the same. We just hunted and planted our fields and fished, and that's what we did. that kind of society is different from a society of strangers, like the societies we live in, where most of the people we see we don't know. And so when if I'm talking to you about something that went on in the Pitahā, I don't have to explain a lot of it. I don't have to give you background information on who I'm talking about. You just know who I'm talking about, and you know mm-hmm. about them. So I'll say, you know, John did this. I don't have to tell you who John is or what's. So I don't have to add all this extra information.
Right.
Recursion in sentences
yep.
is the ability to add extra information to each individual sentence or phrase. So if I say, the man is here, you might ask, what man? What man are you talking about? But if I say, the man who is tall is here, you'll say, oh, that man. Because I give you the relative clause, which is a sentence inside another sentence, gives you extra information. It gives you old information so you can follow the story that I'm telling you now. And the Pitahā don't need to do that because they know who they're talking about already. That kind of information within the individual sentence is not required in Pitahā. Now, the other thing in the immediacy of experience, you don't generalize about things that go into the future. You talk about experiences that you've had or that someone who is alive at the time that it's talked about has seen. So if I use a number, I can describe an entity in front of me with a number. So that, in a sense, is an immediacy of experience. But as soon as I invent a number, I've got something that generalizes across all kinds of experiences. So 1 and 2 and 3, these numbers have properties on their own that have nothing to do with a particular experience.
Right.
And there are generalizations about ones and twos and threes. And so the Pitahā avoid that, not because they're stupid or not because they are incapable of arithmetic. In fact, I know of Pitahā children who've been kidnapped and raised by Brazilians outside the village who work in stores and do math just fine.
Right. So it's not an inability. It's not like there's the math area of their brain, the counting of area of their brain doesn't work somehow.
Right.
It's cultural.
That's right. And so each of the claims about the Pitahā, the lack of numbers, the lack of recursion, the lack of color words, the lack of quantifier words like all and each and every has caused its own little controversy and sometimes big controversies within linguistics. Probably big controversy in linguistics is an oxymoron, but a controversy in linguistics. So I've taken down a lot of researchers over the years from a variety of institutions, psychologists, philosophers, linguists, anthropologists, to verify these claims or to test my claims. And the results are beginning to convince people that, so we've published, myself and some psychologists from MIT and Stanford, a couple of different papers on Pitahā memory, Pitahā color class, Pitahā numbers, the lack thereof. And so people are starting to say, well, maybe these people are, as Dan describes them. And then what does that mean? Well, it means numbers are not innate. Recursion is not innate in grammar. It doesn't come out of the brain directly into grammar.
Right.
And so it's related to their culture in the sense that you don't need the recursion tool for sentences since its main function is to pack clarifying information into individual sentences. You don't need that so much in a society of intimates. And you also don't put old information inside of new information in Pitahā in a way that I describe in the book. That's a violation of immediacy of experience because each sentence should be a new assertion. Or have the form of a new assertion.
Right.
Now, we can talk about how Pitahā tells stories because in the stories, what they show a richness of language. You know, so Chomsky has wanted to argue that languages are you can translate anything from one language to another. And because we share a universal grammar, and aside from a few words and things that one culture might not have, like we don't have the word for haggis in most dialects of English,
or
you can pretty much translate. But if I'm right, it's not always possible to translate from one language to another. But that doesn't mean, say, that Pidha is simpler or inferior to English.
Do they have written language at all?
I developed a written language for them, but they don't use it. I was trying to teach. They wanted to learn to read and write at one time because they saw Brazilian river traders who would come up looking at books and keeping records and using money. And they knew that these people could cheat them, so I started classes. And after several months, I wrote this word on the board, and the Pidha in the room all read it. There were about 30 Pidha, and they said, Miggy. And they all started laughing. And I said, why are you laughing? And they said, that sounds just like our word for ground.
It is your
word for ground. And they said, well, is that what you're trying to do? We don't write our language. And they were uninterested from that point on.
That's it. I'm not interested.
Yeah.
And there's another story similar, not to do with the written language per se, but just in the way that they interact with the world, was a story of making canoes I think it was the story of making canoes, how you got them. You got a teacher from a village upstream to teach them how to make canoes because they said, we like the canoes from this guy. He makes great canoes. And then, oh no, we don't make canoes.
Yeah, I mean, they kept coming to me. They knew this Brazilian lived downriver about a day and a half by canoe, and it would only take me about 4 hours in my motorboat to get to his place. And they said, "We've seen this guy make canoes. We know he makes canoes. Let's go down there, and you can get us some canoes from him." And I said, "You wait here. I'll be back to the village." So I took off and I went down and I talked to this guy. And spent the night with him, got him to come up river and teach the Pidha how to make a canoe. So we went out into the jungle, four Pidha men and this Brazilian man and myself, and we selected a tree that was good wood to make a canoe from. So I told him, I said, they're supposed to do all the work, except you show them different parts of, but I don't want you doing the work. I want them doing the work so they learn how to do it. And he had his tools, and so they spent days in the jungle working on this. I didn't spend all the time with them, but I went out every day and spent some time watching them do it, and they mastered the whole process. He said, they really know what they're doing. So they got the canoe. The canoe was working, and then about 3 days later, they came to me, and they said, one canoe's not enough. We need more canoes. And so I had now bought tools for them, and I brought the three major tools out of my storeroom that you needed to make a canoe with, and I said, here, go make a canoe. And they looked at me and laughed, and they said, Pidha don't make canoes. And so that experience that I had paid this fellow to have with them was just a fun experience for them. They weren't going to change their culture. I mean, who was I? I mean, who did I think I was trying to change their culture? Pidhas don't make canoes.
Yeah, Pidhas don't make canoes. They don't write their own language. They don't, what other thing? I mean, there are just these things in their culture that they don't do, that they see the Brazilians, the Brazilians do, the Portuguese, the people around them do, and they know that they can be done, but they're not interested.
Right. Another thing the Pidha don't like to do is spend their entire day working. The Pidha are...
They've got it right.
I should preface what I'm saying by saying I don't know any group of people who are fitter than the Pidha. They are the ultimate survivalists. No matter what kinds of television shows we have about survival, none of those people could last at all with the Pidha in the jungle, their skills and knowledge. But having said that, I know they can work really hard, much harder than most people I know, they prefer not to. So it takes them about 3 or 4 hours a day to provide food for their family. They just go out and fish, bring back some fish. It takes them about an hour to make a house, maybe 8 hours if they really make an elaborate construction. and they like to just sit around the fire and laugh and eat baked potatoes fish or jungle fruit or whatever they have. And they can't understand why Brazilians work so hard in the hot sun all day, every day. And they can't understand why I just sit motionless most of every day looking at paper.
Right. Why would you want to do that? There are other nice things to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that they've got it right? I mean, has your study of their culture, are you convinced that they have a different way of looking at things that might make them happier somehow than people in Western worlds?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to quantify happiness. I had some psychologists down who themselves said, these must be the happiest people we've ever seen. And I said, yeah, but how would you quantify that? How would you convince somebody that they're happier than other people? And they said, look, every time we look at somebody, they're smiling or laughing. I think the best thing to do is measure how long they spend smiling and laughing every day, and then measure how long other people in the world spend smiling and laughing. I bet you they come out ahead. And if that's not happiness, it's pretty close.
Yeah.
They're not worried. There's no word for worry in Pitaha. They can say they're thinking about something, but it's not a word that means worry necessarily. They don't worry about the future. Now, that doesn't mean they don't get concerned. If somebody's child is sick, they will run immediately for help. They will do whatever they have to do to take care of their children. It's not like they're unconcerned. But they don't sit around fretting. And each Pitaha has confidence that they can take care of themselves, so they don't need to worry about we worry about our employers. Are they going to keep me on? Are they going to do this? We always worry in terms of what other people might do to us. But the Pitaha aren't worried about that. They take care of themselves. And their society is organized like that. And this lack of concern for the past, lack of worry about the future, and self-confidence, I think, leads to a real strong sense of contentment that you see in the Pitaha. You see them lying on a beach. I went down with another researcher in September, and they looked at the Pitaha lying around the beach and talking, and they said, well, I certainly don't sense a lot of angst here.
That's right. But one of the... An interesting aspect to it also, I mean, there are only around 300 individuals of this tribe that still exist, right? So, you know, they're very happy, but in terms of, you know, evolutionary success, the success of the peoples, they're not taking over the world.
No, they're not taking over the world because they're very good ecologists. They take care of themselves given the environmental limitations that they have. Their culture has evolved to fit a particular ecological niche that they have been in for centuries. Of course, other Amazonian groups have as well, but the thing that makes the Pitaha stand out is when they see other cultures, they don't want what those other cultures have necessarily. They'll take a pot here and there, an aluminum pot or some matches or fish hooks, but they're not wanting the boat that all this stuff was delivered in. They don't want an airplane. They don't want a car. They don't want modern. They don't want Western clothes. So they're very happy. But sure, they're not multiplying beyond their borders. Their numbers have grown, though. In September, I saw the Brazilian Indian Agency had just done a recent census, and they're up to about 700 now. So that's not a huge number of people, but they're doing very well. It's difficult to say that because they haven't taken over Brazil,
right,
and because they're still recovering from a huge trauma, you know, the trauma that all South American Indians or all American Indians suffered when the Europeans came to the continents. They're still recovering from that. Most American Indians still are, but the Pitaha are getting pretty back to... pretty close back to their original state of contentment, if the descriptions back then meet what we know about them today.
I'd like to take this opportunity to play the video, promo video of your documentary that you've been working on, The Grammar of Happiness, that we can talk about. So I'm just going to play that very quickly. Let's see if I get this on full screen.
Jesus died. He died for the sins of the world. He died on the cross so that these people could live in heaven forever. And if we don't take the message to them, the Christians who do have the message, we are failing him and disrespecting the offer that he made on the cross for everyone else.
I was raised in Southern California, and I came from a very blue-collar family. My stepfather worked in a packing shed. My father was a cowboy. My mother was a waitress. But my main aim was, and had been since I was 18 years old, to translate the Bible for a group of people who didn't have the Bible. They called themselves the Hiai Chehe, which means the straight ones. In our languages, a pagaiso, a crooked head, a twisted head.
I was going to represent God here. I had a responsibility to give God a tribe, to give a tribe Jesus, to win a tribe for Christ. The dilemma for the Christian missionary is that ultimately, for your message to work, you have to convince them that they're wrong.
I just can't find any evidence for God. They define everything according to the way they're living at the moment. The word for ear is awe, and the word for skin is awe, and the word for foreigner is awe, and the word for hand is awe, and the word for Brazil nut shell is awe. They don't have any numbers.
It seems that every time I change my mind, I do make people mad.
Why on earth would it be racist to report the results of my research? This is shocking to me, and it often angers me considerably.
So the grammar of happiness, got some pinare who are floating down the Amazonian jungle. It looks just beautiful. Looks idyllic almost.
It is a beautiful area.
can you tell us a little bit about the whistle talking that we heard? The fact that these people can communicate by whistling to each other. I mean, I'm trying to think of the times maybe in my own use of language that I have used just sound to communicate. So just just that kind of a
right
acknowledgement of something that somebody has said, but not actually conveying ideas without the use of words.
Right. I mean, but even that little example from English shows you that it's possible to communicate some things with just pitch and just with the frequency of your vibration of your vocal cords, high or low pitch. But with the Pitahā, since they have, in English, we don't have words distinguished by tone. We have intonation, but that's something else. So in Pitahā, let me give you an example. I gave some on that little promo video, but the word for hand is awe, yeah. And the word for foreigner is awe. Or take the word for knife. The word for knife is kahai iwe, and the word for arrow is kahai iwe. If I whistle those, the word for knife is, and the word for arrow is and it turns out that the Pitahā can communicate not just a small number of things, but a complete anything we can talk about using consonants and vowels, they can talk about using tones. And it turns out they're not the only people that can do this. There are other groups in the Amazon, you know, a couple of others that can. And even in Europe, you find some in the Canary Islands, for example. The Pitahā can also hum their language to each other. And I have examples of this on my website. If you go to my website and look at videos of the Pitahā, there's a video of a Pitahā communicating, whistling, and another video of a woman communicating to a child just by humming.
And is it similar? Is it again similar to like the clicking languages that are found in Africa?
Actually, some of the click languages, if you have tones, it's easy then to whistle your language. The click languages have, a click is a consonant like P or T or B or M, but it's a different kind of consonant, and we don't have those kinds of consonants in English. So if I close off the back of my throat, I can make sounds like and those are different kinds of clicks. But it's not the same as tones, which make it possible to whistle or hum. And so that's a really cool adaptation that the Pitahā have. And when they, you know, we can't talk with our mouths full because our vocal apparatus has evolved so that if a chimp makes noises with its mouth full, it's not in any danger of choking to death. But if a human being talks with its mouth full, they're in danger of choking themselves to death because food can fall down the trachea, because that's the trade-off in the evolution of the human vocal apparatus. To have a wider range of loud sounds we can use, we expose the trachea to food. But the Pitahā can hum while their mouth is full, so they actually get the benefits of both worlds.
They can talk while they eat. That's right. I think what led you, as you were listening and you were paying attention to their use of language, what triggered your understanding that the whistling was actually communication, and that they were actually communicating pretty complex ideas?
Well, when I went to the jungle with them one time, and we were talking and everything, they were going to go hunting, and they said, "Oh, you're making a lot of noise." And I said, "Well, I don't think I'm making. Yeah, you're making a lot of noise. We got to hunt now, so you stand here by this tree. We'll come back and get you when we're done." So I'm out in the middle of the jungle. I had no idea where I was, and they just left me there. I didn't have a weapon or anything, and I was imagining all kinds of creatures that might, you know, be looking in my direction.
Yeah.
Anyway, I heard these whistles, and I thought, you know, well, it's funny, they whistle while they walk around in the jungle, but they were actually communicating, I found out later. You know, they were telling each other, "I see signs over here, what was it? It was this kind of animal." So just talking about hunting, but whistling, which makes less noise, it doesn't sound as threatening to some animals, but it helps them to stay quieter. And then I noticed that they whistle a lot in the village to each other, and it wasn't just they were carrying a tune. They were actually communicating with one another.
Do they have music? Do they sing to each other?
Well, because their language is tonal, they have something that's like music. I call it musical speech because the rhythm sounds like they're singing. But in fact, if you analyze it, it's just the tones on the words and nothing else. Mm-hmm. So it's not a new melody that they've written. It's the melody of the words themselves, the inherent melody of the words. And they're talking about things that have just happened. They haven't written lyrics for a new composition, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they enjoy this musical speech, and they talk about new information very often in this musical speech. So if somebody's had a dream and they've had, you know, they've learned something else out, you know, that they didn't know before, they'll sit right up at 3 a.m. and start what sounds like singing, but it's this musical speech. It's very happy. They enjoy it. It's one form of entertainment. They'll walk around in a circle for 1 hour, 2 hours. I've seen them walk around in a circle with off and on for 72 hours without stopping while they're doing this musical speech and having a great time.
And in the book, you also describe that their sleep patterns are fairly random. They just sleep for short periods of time and wake up from dreams and sing their dreams and then go back to sleep.
I mean, they don't have to, you know, punch a clock for
right.
one thing.
Right.
They don't. I mean, I've thought about this. You know, they don't have to It's not even clear that 8 hours sleep in a row is the essential form of sleep.
Right.
But even if it were, they don't need to accumulate all of this sleep because they're going to get up, they're going to go out and fish for a couple of hours and come back and sleep if they want to, or eat, or whatever they want to do. Their day is their own. Nobody tells you how to spend your day. Even parents don't necessarily, except when they're very, well, they just don't tell anybody what to do, how to spend your day. You're completely free. If you don't want to go hunting or fishing, fine. You go hungry, but you spend your day how you want to. So sleep is part of that. People might get up. If there's a full moon, you might have people playing tag and screaming and laughing all night long. And if it's dark and rainy, they'll be huddled around a fire, and they'll be talking. Some will doze off and then get back up and talk some more. They just don't worry about getting in 8 hours of sleep.
I'd like to take another opportunity to thank our sponsor for this hour of programming. If you would like a free audiobook download, I would like to suggest to you to go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, and you'll be able to get a free audiobook download from our sponsors, audible.com. They have thousands, tens of thousands of titles that are available to you in all sorts of different genres. Unfortunately, Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes is not one of the selections. I looked for it. So Daniel, if you'd like to get on that. I'm sure people would love to hear this story, since it's such a vivid story, hear this story read to them. But as a selection this week, I thought that a good book this week would be The Edge of Physics. The Edge of Physics. We're actually going to be speaking with the author, Anil Ananthaswamy, in the next hour. And The Edge of Physics is a book about his explorations into the edges, the extremes of the earth, to find out about physics and the scientists who do the work and what it's like to go to extremes for science. So The Edge of Physics, if you'd like to have that as a free audiobook download, just go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki and you'll be able to get your own audiobook thanks to audible.com and their wonderful service. So thanks very much. Dan, we're getting towards the end of the hour here, and I have so many questions that I still want to ask you. Living in the jungle and going on from what you were saying earlier, the way they don't really tell anybody what to do, is it pretty consistent within their language, this idea of personal responsibility? Do you think that ties in with everything? Or individual responsibility?
In one very interesting sense, perhaps, each verb takes one of a small number of suffixes, ends to the verb, that tells you where you got the information. I ask you, is John here? And you say, he is not here. One suffix that you'll put on the verb would indicate, he is not here because I saw him leave. It's direct observation. Another one would be, he is not here because I heard someone say he's not here. That's hearsay. And another one would be, he is not here because, you know, his canoe's not here, and so I assume he's not here. That's inference. And those little suffixes, just a couple of syllables each, have all that information built into them. And so you should let people know the information and your own evaluation of the evidence by which you're making this assertion. So there is a bit of personal responsibility in that.
Yeah. Are you going back to the jungle again this year? Are you?
Yeah, I was there. I was there twice last year, and I hope to be there. We're waiting on word from the National Science Foundation, and if we get funding, a small group, will be going down in August, probably.
Now, I brought up Noam Chomsky at the beginning of the hour. You actually are a Chomsky expert. You've done a lot of research into his ideas, but your ideas kind of run counter to what he's come up with, and he doesn't seem really happy about it. So
no. I mean, he recently said in a German magazine that had a story about me, he said, Dan, wants to get famous, but he doesn't realize that famous people have to have ideas, and he doesn't have any.
Wow.
So, he's not real happy. I mean, I'm not trying to go out of my way to attack Chomsky. I mean, I think he's a fine person. He's been helpful to me in my career, in fact. But the concept of a universal grammar, that we're all born with an innate knowledge of grammar, and that human languages all develop from a common core like that, I think is just dead wrong. And I say that pretty bluntly. In fact, in my new book that I'm currently writing, that'll come out next year from Random House, I make the case that language is simply a cultural tool, that it's learned and developed, and that there's really no evidence that there's a universal grammar or a language instinct.
Hmm. And you think that the Pinada, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong again, but that they...
The Pinaha
are, that the evidence from their society is sufficient to be able to make those claims.
Well, the new book is not even about the Pinaha. It's about lots of other languages.
Okay.
and doing a conceptual analysis of the idea of a universal grammar and showing mm-hmm. how it doesn't work. But for the Pinaha, sure, if you make a prediction that all languages of the world are built on a common core of recursion, and I show you a syntax that doesn't have recursion, that's a counterexample.
Yep.
And that's the only, I mean, so that's like the black swan, right? So if I say all swans are white and you show me one that's black, I was wrong.
Are you thinking at all of bringing any genetic information into any of this study? I know there's just a study out this week that looked at the songbird genome, the zebra finch, and actually found some specific genes that are responsible for the acquisition of language. Do you think that looking at those kinds of studies and trying to draw parallels within the human genome and human language is a direction that may or may not support this universal grammar or language acquisition device?
Well, it's often claimed that there are language genes, but there's no specific region of the brain that is specialized for language, contrary to what a lot of people seem to think. There is no gene that's known to be associated with language. The interesting thing is humans have fewer genes than corn. Corn has, I would expect to find a language gene in corn before I found it in humans. We are known for the ability of our genes to work together to produce complex behaviors and complex phenotypes that really can't be traced back to a simple gene. And most of the genes that are associated with language are also associated with lots of activities that involve sequential activities, behaviors that involve sequential activities. So riding a bike and putting a sentence together are taken care of in similar parts of the brain, the same part of the brain with genes that that work together, because those are similar kinds of operations. So what language is, in my opinion, is a tool that's built off lots of different and independent cognitive capacities to solve the ultimate question of human survival, which is communication. The first question to ask about humans is, why do we want to talk with each other in the first place? No other primate does.
Some people don't want to talk to people.
Yeah. But we won't live without being able to talk to one another. Communication is not just a luxury for us. It's a question of survival in every normal case. And so that's the first question. And once you say, why do we want to communicate, and you analyze what does communication require, the similarity among languages of the world just follows. You don't need to say anything about a gene. The similarity just follows from those considerations.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. This has been just a fascinating exploration of I know, although very brief compared to the years of study that you've put into this, into language and these people and the jungles, and all of your experiences cannot be boiled down to 1 hour, unfortunately. But thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And everybody out there who's watching right now, this has been Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. And next week, we are going to be talking about the edge of physics with Anil Ananthaswamy. You can download Dr. Kiki's Science Hour from iTunes and find past episodes at twit.tv/Kiki. You can find me online at drkiki.tv or follow me on Twitter at Dr. Kiki or on my Facebook fan page. Also, if you need more sciencey goodness, because there's always a need for more of it, you can listen to This Week in Science, which can be found at twis.org. And this book, Daniel Everett's book, Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, was the Twist Book Club Book of the Month for the month of March. And if you're interested in taking a look at the past books or even the book that we're reading for April, which is Collider by Paul Halpern, you can go to twistbookclub.ning.com. And if you're interested in any more information on Dr. Everett's work or the Pinaha, be sure to visit his website. I'll have the link in our show notes. He's at Illinois State University. And there are tons of links and resources at his website that are available for you. So thank you for watching. Thanks for listening. I will see you next week. Thanks for tuning into the Science Hour. All I ask is 1 hour a week. And remember, 1 hour a week makes your world a more interesting place.